Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the Anchorage Hilton, where Senator Lisa Murkowski is addressing the Alaska World Affairs Council. Following her recent travels abroad, Senator Murkowski shares her global insights. Next on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans. First, the news.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Please continue eating and going through the buffet. I'm Rod Finkel, and I'm the president of the council. We're kind of operating on a wing and a prayer today. Our executive director and I have been monitoring Senator Murkowski's progress from Juneau since 7 this morning, following Alaska Airline flight number 73, which was canceled or delayed several times. In fact, many times. Anyway, Senator Murkowski is in the air right now. We're hoping that her arrival is uneventful and safe. I would like now to introduce our head table. To my very far left is Chuck Becker, a former board member, a past president, and presently a director emeritus of our board of directors. Now Chuck will introduce our guest speakers.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the interest of your time and her time, I give you Senator Lisa Murkowski.
Thank you all. Well, you know, in Alaska, it's the weather. And it's not just Alaska. It was Juneau, for heaven's sakes. But it ended up being a beautiful day. By the time that jet came in, the sky was about as blue as my jacket. And you're looking and you're thinking, how? Anyway, I have so much to talk about this morning. And I had so looked forward to this engagement. We've been planning it for so long now. So I appreciate the invitation to be with you, and I'm really, really glad that we didn't have to delay and reschedule. I want to speak this afternoon and share some of my insights about what I think is really some of the hottest hot spots that we have in the news today. It was just about a month ago, maybe 5 weeks ago now, that I joined with the Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, and several other colleagues to go to the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I want to take a few minutes this afternoon and just share with you some of my observations and impressions from this very, very important trip. Overall, I will tell you, I was very encouraged by the professionalism, by the commitment of the men and women in uniform. They always, always make us proud. I was encouraged by the civilian institutions that serve our front lines in the war on terror. And particularly since the surge in Afghanistan began, we've begun to see some progress towards helping establish a country that can govern itself, defend its borders, be an important ally in fighting terrorism. We recognize that there are areas that we clearly need to focus on. We have to remain realistic about the enormous challenges that we face over there. But let me recap the trip. It was 15,000 miles from Washington, D.C. We did it in less than 5 days, 10 and a half time zones. Go figure. Kabul is a half an hour difference from Islamabad. Anyway, we used to have our own time zones here, too, but we started out, made a quick stop in Kuwait, visited with the ambassador there, and we just kind of reminded again of that very important partnership with that particularly country that we have in supporting our efforts in Iraq. We then headed on to Islamabad met with Prime Minister Gilani. We met with the Army Chief of Staff, General Kiani, and our outstanding ambassador that we have over there, Ambassador Ann Patterson. Great team of folks over there. Then we went to Afghanistan. We met with President Karzai and his national security team, sat down for many hours with General McChrystal. We visited the police training center there in Kabul. We were thoroughly briefed by Ambassador Eikenberry, a great team that he has. And then we went down to the south and visited the troops in the field at the Regional Command South down in Kandahar. We visited with the 2nd Marine Expeditionary Brigade at Camp Bastion. And then later that afternoon, we went down to a forward operating base in Helmand Province, which, of course, is all in the news today in the southern part of the country. So focusing first on Afghanistan. When you are in the streets, on the streets of Kabul, you are clearly reminded that this is a nation whose security situation has been deteriorating steadily since 2005. In Afghanistan, war is not necessarily a political decision. It's really a way of life there. And we see that play out in so many ways. Many reasons for this, not the least of which, is the very underfunded, very undermanned Afghan security forces. The Afghan police had just received a raise, if you will, or an increase in salary. They're getting paid $165 a month. But just several months ago, I believe it was November, the pay that they received was less than $100 a month. Now, you compare that to what the Taliban are reportedly paying their insurgents. They're getting between $200 and $300 a month. So, you know, if you're trying to figure out how to feed your family, it's not so much who's right in this war. It's what can I do? What do I have to do to feed my family? When we talk about how Afghanistan is going to bring up their own forces, whether it's in the police or within their army, we just say, well, you know, go out. You got lots of people there. Train them up. It's not as easy as just going out and increasing the level of recruits. 1 in 5 police recruits test positive for drugs, and only 1 in 10 are able to read and write. This whole issue of literacy is one that just absolutely stops you in your tracks. We were talking about, when we were visiting the Central Training Center there in Kabul, they've got several facilities. We've got many facilities around the Kabul province, and the one that we went to was offering an 8-week course. 520 students are enrolled. But they were trying to do more to bring people from the south in to beef up the level of recruits. Well, from the south, the literacy rate is, in speaking with the general who is dealing with the training, he said, out of the South, the statistics that they give us say that if there are 10% who come to us that have a level of literacy, that's good. He says, I figure it's probably close to 5% that are literate. And I said, well, help me out. How are you defining literacy? And he says, it's about a third grade level. I said, well, how are you? I mean, I know how training goes on in other operations. You know, he says, there is no classroom type setting because we cannot make the assumption that people understand when we write something on the board. They cannot take notes. It's all we went into a classroom and they were demonstrating how to disassemble the weaponry. And there was nothing on the board. It was all what we would describe as show and tell. But you're dealing with a level of literacy that is almost incomprehensible. And one of the goals for this 8-week training program is to teach these men, and there are some women, but predominantly men, to teach these men their numbers 1 to 10. Because when we put them out on a checkpoint, and we tell them, you know, look for suspicious vehicles, and when you see something, make a notation of the license. But you can't make a notation of the license because you don't know your numbers. This is what we are faced with. And it's not just the literacy. We're bringing in recruits from the South where just the amenities of life that we take for granted simply don't exist. They come into the central training facility, and they've got a bunk area. I don't know if you call it a bunk area. It's just a big, huge tent with 200 bunks in it. Well, for many of these men, it's the first time that they have not been on the ground, so getting up in the second bunk is an adventure. And then they said, you want to talk about adventure? It's the bathrooms. Running water, they've not seen it before. Hot water coming out of a tap is something that they've decided, they initially said they weren't going to deal with it, but they basically give the first day for people to explore, to turn the water on and off, to turn the light switches on and off, to get up into their bed. It's something that we just have a difficult time relating to. So when we say, train them up, I think we need to appreciate the level that they have to start with. And despite these very sobering realities, the challenges of the police work there in Afghanistan, they're suffering the highest casualty rates of all types of security forces that are fighting the Taliban. These really brave individuals are going into harm's way with a very daunting task in front of them, and very little in terms of resources. We met with the defense minister, and he indicated that they were very encouraged because in December they had had the highest number of recruits ever recorded, and there were so many that they just couldn't even process them quickly enough, and they were very encouraged by that. But the goals that the president has set are extraordinarily high. They're looking to increase the police force from 93,000 to 160,000 by 2013. The army increases from 95 to 240,000. Substantial. And the president is looking to perhaps implement a draft to meet these recruitment goals. Had an interesting meeting with President Karzai. You know, if we think that there are pressures on us in Congress, I have to tell you, all we need to do for a little reassurance is kind of look over to the life of President Karzai to know what real pressure is about. You know, to the east of him, he's got Pakistan, this nation with deep cultural ties to the Taliban, territorial ownership of Afghanistan's southern trade route to the sea. Over to the west, you've got Iran, the exodus of the Afghan refugees that are pouring across the border into Persian lands since the Taliban were in power and creating this instability. More recently, you've got the U.S. bases in Afghanistan that are growing, as well as the standing bases that exist in the Gulf region. These are seen as seen by Tehran, anyway, as a potential platform for launching operations into Iran. And then in the midst of this very regional pressure cooker, you've got President Karzai, who's like sitting on the top of a volcano practically. And given then what is happening within the government, the widespread lack of trust in his government as well as his security forces, the day that we were there was the day after the parliament had rejected 17 of his 24 cabinet nominees. So he's sitting there thinking, well, you know, I thought I had a plan and how we were going to move forward with the governance, but you know, maybe I need to do a little reassessment here. But you know, when you think about the situation that Karzai is in, it's pretty tough. Kind of tough waking up in the morning. I bet he probably wishes that he had a snow day that he could avoid. But it was interesting discussing with the president the issues that Afghanistan faces as they deal with just the legitimization of their constitution. The country desperately needs to institutionalize open, corruption-free parliamentary elections. They need to resolve the date for their elections, and we recognize that this is important to their overall success and the strategy, just the legitimacy of the government, and for our military commanders who will need to coordinate the security as that election goes forward. The president has specifically asked for help from the U.S. and the coalition forces to make sure that these very critical parliamentary elections proceed in a fair manner. Now, I think we recognize that while the outcome of our efforts in Afghanistan are still very clearly uncertain. I think it's fair to suggest that in the long term, the impact there will likely be decided more by ballots than by bullets. And I think when we look to some of the keys to success in the region, things that bring about more stable government, one thing that we need to do is ensure that our military objectives are compatible with the political goals for the region. And when you think about those areas where the Afghanistan people look to the United States and say, you know, thank you. Yes, it may be for the forces that are there to provide for that protection, but quite honestly, it's the infrastructure piece. 30 years ago, a dam, the Kajiki Dam down in Helmand Province, was built. It was done with Afghani labor. It was a project that provided jobs and security. And now, decades after the fact, this dam generates 31 megawatts of power for the thousands of citizens in the Kandahar region and in the Helmand province. And the Afghanis were so appreciative of the U.S. involvement in this project that they dubbed one of the communities, a city located on the Helmand River, it's Lashkar Gah, they refer to it as Little America, because they appreciated that contribution. And I think it is so important to recognize what is happening on the civilian side, what USAID is helping to facilitate, what we're doing from just the perspective of bringing agriculture in. It was interesting because following our congressional delegation was the Secretary of Agriculture, Secretary Vilsack, who was going through Afghanistan, going through the region to see what it was that they could do to help. We're looking to how you can convert the fields that are growing poppies into legal crops and into lasting crops, whether it's pomegranates or whether it's dates or grapes. But working with the country, working with people in the provinces to do so much more that is so much more lasting. I had an opportunity. We had breakfast in Kabul at the embassy. And they had brought together some Alaskans that were working there in the embassy. And I had a chance to meet a gentleman who's from Eagle River here. He's worked for USAID for years. He's been over in Pakistan. And now he's over in he's the rep in the Kunar province. And we were talking about all of the issues that he is involved with and recognizing the level of participation that we have from Alaskans that are just going over there to help with the effort. You know, we can be very critical about what is happening in Afghanistan. We can be very skeptical. But I think it's fair to say that it is a better place to live than certainly where we were 9 years ago. And we can argue whether or not we're able to win the hearts and minds of the Afghan people, but we can say with certainty that since the Taliban's power has been reduced, we've seen literacy increased by almost 15%. We're seeing fewer children dying. 10 times as many citizens have access to health care. If you're a woman in Afghanistan, you can get an education. I mean, these are huge gains. In 2001, there were approximately 30 miles of paved roads in this country. Today, they've got paved roads that stretch nearly 2,500 miles. We did the math on that. That's an 8,333% increase in 9 years. Think of what we could do with that here in Alaska. I might even get to Nome. But I think it is fair to recognize the progress that we have made as a nation, doing the right thing, extending a compassionate hand as we work with so many over there. Now, I mentioned the gentleman from Eagle River that I ran into and had an opportunity to just kind of pick his brain on things. But we were going down to the south in Helmand, as again you're aware in the news, this is an area that is very, very volatile right now. This is where we're seeing the march on Marja. It's truly kind of the wild, wild west of this very dangerous country. And we've got the 2nd Marine Expeditionary Brigade that is in command down there. and we had one of the new V-22 Osprey that was assigned to us to take us from one part of the area to another, and we're getting ready to go into the Osprey, and this young Marine, I mean a young Marine, kind of bounds across the gravel there, and, you know, the rotors are running, and he's yelling at me. He says, "Are you the senator from Alaska?" And I said, "Yes." And he says, "I'm from Big Lake." And I have to tell you, you know, first of all, being on an aircraft like this was nothing short of phenomenal in terms of how it flies. And watching the flight crew as they literally are hanging out the back like this. And I'm thinking, that's one of our boys. And you just can't help but feel proud, I tell you. Talk just a second here about what we're seeing down in the South, because it is so much in the news. In the past 12 months, this province down in Helmand has evolved from a Taliban stronghold to pockets. Now, they're not big, but they're growing pockets of liberty, and in that liberty, they provide some hope to the Afghan people. And this is thanks to the NATO coalition troops. Y'all know that With the announcement of President Obama in bringing an additional 30,000 troops into Afghanistan, many of whom are bound for Helmand, we had a chance to go down to the area again and to walk through a bazaar in a community called Garmsir. And we were outside of one of the forward operating bases, but the Marine unit was not the unit that was providing protection in this community. Two months ago, there was no bazaar. As of November of 2009, the bazaar was completely empty. People were afraid to go out in the streets. There were no vendors. And we walked down the streets of Garmsir with protection provided to us by the Afghan police. And it was a full-on market selling some interesting things, used shoes and just anything you could possibly imagine. But it was a recognition that, okay, we've made some progress here. But I will tell you, we may be making progress in providing a level of security, but the progress in the southern part of the country as it relates to treatment of women is non-existent. I was told by General Nicholson, he says, when you walk through this market, you will probably notice that you will not see many women. We walked through the market for about 45 minutes. There was not one woman. The women do not do the shopping. The women do not participate in any of the selling as a vendor. The women are not present. And there were small girls, young girls, but as soon as you reach puberty, you're tucked inside, and there is no female presence publicly. So I'm walking down the street, and I had a scarf on, as was appropriate, and small children running around and looking at you, and I figured it was the blue eyes. Because I've been in Japan and spent some time there, and the blue eyes always attract the Japanese, the little kids. And then I realized they kept staring at my face, and it was because they don't see the face of a woman. So we've got a long ways to go there. But we sat in that, after the walk through the bazaar, we sat in the, it wasn't a tent. It was a plastic visqueen roofed over area, and that was the camp. We met with the tribal leaders, sat around a very rough-hewn table, and talked about the mission and what was happening. And through the interpreters, it was made very, very, very clear. They want to make this fight their own. They want to call the shots. They want to lead. And that was good. That was very, very encouraging. And I think many of those tribal leaders that I had an opportunity to meet with are getting that chance to lead sooner than they may have thought. As I mentioned, the the town of Marja. Last week, we had 15,000 U.S., NATO, and Afghan soldiers. They began the offensive to retake Marja, which is really a very major stronghold of the Taliban there in the province. Nearly a week into the offensive, Taliban resistance, we're finding, is getting more sporadic, less frequent, and that is a hopeful sign. But we know that in the wake of this fighting, we've had many, many families, over 1,200 families that have been driven from their homes. We've had 15 civilians die to this point. Brigadier General Nicholson has reported that, well, he thinks that the major fighting may end soon. It may be a month or so before the entire battle space is clear to the insurgents. I think perhaps some of the best news coming out of the field this week is that, by all accounts, the Afghan soldiers have stepped up. They're fighting well, and that is a good thing to say. And I have to say, though, that while the tide may be turning against the Taliban in Afghanistan, we can't forget that this is a war of attrition, not one of annihilation. The bad guys are going to be there a lot longer after our coalition troops leave. I think we recognize that the Afghan people have known of war for longer than most of our troops have been alive, and they've learned to be cautious about pledging their allegiance outside of their tribe. There was considerable discussion while we were over there about the timetable, which the president had announced earlier, setting July 2011 as that time to begin the drawdown. And the fear that was expressed was that if you have this predictable U.S. withdrawal, we see this deficit of trust. And that was kind of the words that they used, deficit of trust, with the leaders there in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. Quite honestly, they've seen nations come in. They've never seen an occupier finish the job and aren't sure that the U.S. is going to either. And many argue that this trust deficit further empowers the Taliban's resistance and really their enduring lure there. But as we demonstrate our resolve, not only in the surge of forces in Afghanistan, we've also got to keep up our engagement with the civilian institutions there in Afghanistan, as well as with the civilian institutions and the governments and the military of Pakistan. Now, I know that I'm well past the 1 o'clock hour. I've got more than I want to talk about. I want to talk about Pakistan just real quickly. I've got a short thing on Iraq and a little bit on Iran. But I understand that you all have things that you need to be to. And so if you have to leave, please don't hesitate to do so. And I'll try to truncate some of my comments here. But I think it is important as we talk about Afghanistan to really try to better understand the dynamics of where we are with Pakistan. When I met with General Kiani and met with the Prime Minister, it was very, very clear to me that there is a real cloud of paranoia coming from both the military side and the government side. And even within the government hierarchy, not just on the military side, there exists some very real divisions between those who support the goals of the United States and its allies and those that are, quite honestly, more sympathetic with the Taliban. And those dynamics really are not very conducive to consensus and to trust. Look at the situation that the Pakistani leaders are in. They've got to defend their decisions to a population of 180 million people, 80% of whom oppose cooperation with the United States in the war on terrorism. They view the current Afghanistan government as pro-India. They fear the prospects of being flanked by enemies on both their eastern and their western borders. And then woven throughout this quilt of insecurity, you've got this trust deficit that I just mentioned we see in Afghanistan, but this weighs on Pakistan as well. In their view, they're looking at it and they're saying there's this historical precedent out there with the United States abandoning Pakistan when it no longer serves U.S. interests. We saw that in the late 1980s with the aftermath of the Soviet withdrawal in Afghanistan. So you've got leaders in Pakistan in kind of a catch-22 type of a situation. If they support the U.S., they will continue to get some very much needed aid. With the Kerry Lugar legislation, we authorized $7.5 billion over the next 5 years. So that's, government wants that. They believe that's helpful. But this, what we would think would be a benevolent attempt to improve the relationships, it's actually had the opposite effect on Pakistan. It inflamed the public, inflamed the masses, who saw this as yet another example of the U.S. exerting its influence over Pakistan and its internal matters. And the military reaction to the funding was to denounce it. So you've got some dynamics at play that are really very unpredictable. There was some news earlier this week. There was a joint Pakistani CIA operation, and it captured Mullah Abul Ghani Baradar. And he's not only the operational commander there of the Afghan Taliban, he's also second only to Mohammad Omar in the hierarchy there in the insurgency. So this is a big catch, but it brings some risk, probably some great risk for Pakistani leadership there. So just kind of laying out some of the difficulties of the situation that we face along this Afghanistan-Pakistan border, I think progress in the region is really going to depend on the primary stakeholders' willingness to take great risk to rebuild their country. I'm going to skip Iraq for a moment. Simply because I'd like to speak to the situation in Iran, which I think we all find so very, very troubling. And I will just note that we continue to watch Iraq very, very closely, but it has been showing good progress, as we have seen, and that is hopeful to us all. But I think we need to listen to the scholars who will remind us that in Iraq, peace in the region is a mere interlude of perpetual war, and we hope that that's not going to be the case as we wind down the operations there in Iraq. There's a couple dates coming up that we know we're watching very carefully. We've got March 7th coming up, that will be the national elections, and then of course December of this year, where we have the combat forces being withdrawn. I had an opportunity to speak with Chuck Jacoby, who is head of the command over there, and he reminded us that as we get closer to the election, we're likely to see greater unrest, greater violence, and of course these are all very troubling. But we have made gains. We have made gains. I want to close my comments on Iran. Obviously, the epicenter of a great deal of international anxiety. I have no doubt that most of you in the room here are familiar with the recent permanent 5+1 or P5+1, the package that was offered to Iran. This is the combination kind of the sticks and the carrots that represent this collective resolve of the most influential nations in the world community. And the deadline for response on this expired at the end of the year. And what did Iran have to say? Well, this week, they declared themselves a nuclear nation. And this announcement comes just on the heels of earlier announcements of their intention to build 10 new uranium enrichment sites. It was just yesterday the United Nations Atomic Energy Agency expressed concern that Iran is working on a warhead to deliver nuclear missiles. Just not too very long ago, just hours ago, Iran's supreme leader says, oh, No, we're not interested in developing nuclear weapons. So, you know, these responses coming out of Iran, very concerning and alarmingly contradictory. These disconcerting responses are clearly drawing international reaction with Russia, with France, both joining the United States in expressing concerns over these latest reports from the Atomic Energy Agency. Unfortunately, China, which has surpassed both the EU and Russia as Iran's most significant trading partner, this is according to the Financial Times last week, China's been silent. And the diplomatic conversations clearly will continue at the highest levels in the hopes that the world will be able to talk Iran off of the ledge that it has placed itself on. But it appears increasingly apparent that talk therapy alone is not going to achieve the desired results. Some things in Congress. Last year, I was a co-sponsor on two pieces of legislation that would help to facilitate U.S. sanctions against Iran. The first would authorize the president to place sanctions on international businesses, including financial institutions, that do business with Iran. And the second would promote disinvestment by U.S. pension funds and other institutional investors in international companies companies that do business over there. The House of Representatives has passed each of these bills. They moved them as standalones, sent them to the Senate. We combined them into the two bills into one. We ratcheted up the sanctions. We passed it by unanimous consent, and now it's back over to the House. It gave me a speech to the legislature yesterday in Juneau, as you know, and I suggested in that address that a nuclear Iran is unthinkable. And it's not just unthinkable from the point of view of the United States or from Israel. It's also unthinkable from the point of view of Iran's Arab neighbors. A nuclear Iran could spark an arms race in the Arab world that will make it ever more difficult to achieve peace in this very troubled region. I learned so much, you always do, when you go overseas, when you have an opportunity to see firsthand, but it really helped me gain a better understanding of these challenges that confront us. As a senator coming from a state like Alaska, where our military community is very strong, I truly feel the weight of war on our nation, on the people that I represent. Our military men and women are fighting so honorably, so incredibly honorably, and doing it not only to create a democracy, but to teach people in the region the value of democracy. And I can think of no higher purpose and truly applaud them for their work, for their dedication, and I certainly commit to give them all that they need to succeed in this very critical area of the globe. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I apologize for my late arrival and for keeping you over, but hopefully my comments have inspired some discussion with you that we can pursue at a later time. So thank you very much.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA with Senator Lisa Murkowski. She was recorded sharing her global insights at a meeting of the Alaska World Affairs Council on February 19th. Following her talk, Senator Murkowski responded to questions from audience members.
Thank you very much for being here, Senator. You alluded very starkly to the problem of illiteracy in Afghanistan. Going back to the 9/11 Commission, they said an important part of our strategy was to support educational alternatives to fundamentalist madrasas and so on in that part of the world. More broadly, globally, we still have 75 million kids who aren't in school at all, and many more who aren't, you know, getting secondary education or anything like that. Would you consider working across the aisle and working with the House in the Congress to urge President Obama to follow through on his campaign commitment to take leadership internationally on creating a global fund for education that's modeled on the global fund to fight HTB and malaria, which has been so successful?
And I appreciate the question because I've had an opportunity back in Washington, D.C. to sit down to talk just about these education initiatives. Had a chance to meet with Melinda and Bill Gates. Melinda Gates is very, very engaged on this, and we talked about the opportunity to truly advance this. And yes, I will tell you, I am so convinced. The statement that I made was, we're going to do more through the ballot than by bullet. We've got to help with the governance structures, but the education component is so key to the evolution of a good governance process. And we are not putting, in my opinion, we are not putting the dollars and the international, the global effort towards the education to counteract what is being done on the other side. So you ask, you kind of challenge me, will I reach across the aisle? Will I go over to the other body? I absolutely will. I think the awareness that we as Americans are now gaining, you have people like Greg Mortensen, his very popular book, Three Cups of Tea. You read about the efforts, or not the efforts, but the impact that one individual can have, and you say, for crying out loud, why are we as a nation not more engaged in helping to facilitate this? When they told us about the example of the Kajiki Dam in Helmand Province and how that had brought about such goodwill in this area, I said, terrific. What have we done since then? You drive through Kabul, and there are some pretty tough-looking housing units. They're all concrete and pretty grim-looking. And I said, this looks like something out of Russia. Well, in fact, the Russians did build those. And you know, in Kabul, the Russians are remembered somewhat fondly for what they did to meet the basic needs of the people: housing, education, water. So this is something that we don't put near enough resource and near enough attention, and yes, I will do so. Thank you for the question.
After your tour in Afghanistan, what would you conclude would be the three fundamental accomplishments the U.S. needs to make there to bring what you would define as a successful withdrawal, and how would you define a successful withdrawal?
Start with the second part first. A successful withdrawal is the ability of us to remove combat troops and leave in place a level of stability that will allow for general commerce to continue, education to continue, and what we would consider to be essentially the day-to-day drill of life. Because right now, one of the goals of our military over there is simply to ensure that commerce is allowed on the roads. I mentioned there's 2,500 miles of paved roads. Well, about every 6 miles, apparently, there is somebody who comes out and basically asks for a payoff for you to receive safe passage through this little unauthorized illegal checkpoint. That's not, and so what is happening is those who would grow the pomegranates say, you got to get them to market. And the market, you're going to go down to the port in Pakistan. You've got to be able to move it. They can't move their goods. So what do? You know, they grow poppies and they can get paid a lot of money by the Taliban. So it's a level of security that will allow for basic life, and it's pretty basic over there, to continue. And you asked The three initiatives, really, again, in speaking with the military, and their initiative is to provide for a period where the area remains safe so that the Afghans can step in themselves and provide for that level of security. The tribal leaders that we met with, and again, this was in a very volatile part of the country, demonstrated a level of commitment that we want to own this, that I'll be honest with you, I didn't expect to see that. I expected them to say, you know, we need the United States, we need the NATO coalition forces, we need you to do this. But there was a level of willingness to engage that I had not anticipated. So I took that as an encouraging sign. Thank you again, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for your time.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Senator Lisa Murkowski. Following her recent travels abroad, Senator Murkowski returned home to Alaska, offering global insights at a meeting of the Alaska World Affairs Council, recorded on February 19th, 2010. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.